Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. So this week, we're going to take the whole week and look at energy in Michigan. Today, we'll focus on solar energy and what it could mean for our state. Then later in the hour, we'll turn to Lansing, where some Democrats in the state House are introducing legislation to allow gay marriage in Michigan. But first, the Annie E. Casey Foundation has issued its annual Kids Count report on the well-being of children across the nation. In Michigan, the outline is a mixed bag, but overall, Michigan is last among Great Lakes states for child well-being. There were improvements in how well kids are doing in school, some improvements in the area of health of kids and the number who have health insurance. But in every category of economic well-being, children in Michigan are in worse shape. Patrick McCarthy is the president and chief executive author of Kids Count. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So first, let's go over some of the improvements. Michigan ranked very high compared to other states in children in families with health insurance. Only 4% of kids are without health insurance in this state. The legislature, at least the Senate anyway, has not voted on expanding Medicaid coverage to more low-income families. And I'm wondering, how necessary is that given Michigan's high ranking?
Well, I think it's important to note that the ranking for health insurance is focused specifically on children. We know from research that when children's parents are not covered by health insurance, children themselves actually are less likely to receive good health care. So while the percentage of children without health insurance in Michigan is relatively low at 4%, and that's a good policy move, we would also encourage policymakers to consider the impact on children when parents don't have health insurance and they don't have a medical reliable home that they can rely on.
So in the family and community section of the report, Michigan has lost ground in the number of children living in high poverty areas. How does that affect the quality of lives of those children?
Well, it's interesting. If you think about the life of a child in poverty, they often are living with parents who are stressed out, who may be depressed and irritable as they're trying to do everything they can to make ends meet, struggling with economic problems from small with a car breaking down to large with the loss of a job. All of that impacts the availability of the parents' energy to devote to the raising of their children.
I guess I'm asking about, instead of living in poverty, but these high poverty areas, which is in your family and community section, I'm just wondering if your family is doing relatively okay, how does living in a high poverty area affect the children?
It's actually a terrific question, and what the research tells us is that even if an individual family is not in poverty, but they're living in a neighborhood which has high rates of poverty of 30, 35, 40% of children in poverty, the outcomes for those children who are not in poverty are also affected. Part of that is because they're more likely to be in communities in which there's a lot of transients, so there's not the connection to neighbors. There's generally a higher crime rate. Schools often do not perform as well. Other kinds of services, parks and recreation, are not as high quality as you would want. Options for child care are not as high quality as you would want for your own child. So all of those things taken together, along with not as many positive role models for finding a path towards opportunity, affect all children living in a poor community.
Now, let's get to the topic you first started talking about. We're higher than the national average with 25% of children living in poverty, one out of four kids in the state living in poverty. Tell me what's happening there.
Well, we know that the recession has had obviously a huge effect on the economic well-being of children. So that's why we looked at how many kids are in poverty now as compared to before the recession. And in Michigan, it went from 19% all the way up to 25%, as you said. And again, what we see is children growing up in poverty having an awfully tough time in life. The research suggests that they are more likely to get involved with drug and alcohol problems, behavioral problems, do poorly in school, more likely to drop out, less likely to attach to a permanent job in the labor force, and more likely to, in fact, be poor themselves. And so you have a multi-generational kind of an impact. So it's one of the most important predictors of long-term outcomes for children is the economic circumstances of their families.
I suppose it only follows that the category of children whose parents lack secure employment is also up. We're told the economy is improving in Michigan, but when 35% of kids, some 813,000 kids, are living in a home where their parent or parents can't find a regular job, you wonder whether everyone in Michigan is benefiting from Michigan's growing prosperity.
That's exactly right. What we've seen both nationally and if you look at individual states like Michigan is that certain sectors of the economy are in fact doing well and starting to come back online. It's the low-skilled workforce that is really having a tough time reconnecting to reliable, permanent kinds of jobs. So this particular statistic looks at whether a parent has a full-time job year-round. And as you say, more than a third of Michigan's children are living in households where the parent, no parent in that household, has a secure job.
Another section looks at children living in households with high housing cost burden. What do you mean by that, and what's the fallout?
We basically see that families that spend more than 30% of their income on housing spend a disproportionate share on housing, so that we see that that varies all over the country depending on the cost of rental housing and purchase, et cetera. In Michigan, 30% of children are living in households with a high housing cost burden. If you put that together with the percentage of children living in poverty, you realize that the money that's available for a family for things like food and medicine and other necessities is even more limited if they're living in a neighborhood where they're paying more than a third of their cost of their income for housing costs.
So I think there's an impulse by many of us to say, well, shouldn't government be doing something about this? I'm just wondering what state government can do to improve this economic situation for struggling families and their children.
Well, the first point to make is that it's important to make sure that the dollars that the state is investing, that those dollars are invested well. And that means investing where there's going to be big payoff. What the research tells us is that investing in early childhood education, in the early years of elementary school, in supporting families so they can be good parents for their children, these are all high payoff investments, but only if the services and supports that are provided are of high quality. It's not just a matter of providing the kind of early childhood services that's essentially babysitting. You want to provide services that, in fact, take advantage of the rapid development of the brain in the early years and the important development of social and emotional habits that are going to pay off in the long run. Very importantly, investing in everything you can do to make sure a child is reading, not just reading on, not just reading at a low level, but reading proficiently by the end of third grade is a huge predictor of how the child's going to do long term.
And that's something where Michigan is actually getting worse, as I read the statistics.
That's correct, and it's starting. It's getting somewhat worse, and it's starting from a bad place. So 69%, almost 70% of fourth graders in Michigan are not reading proficiently. So let me say that again. Almost 70% of Michigan children of all categories, income, race, ethnicity, almost 70% are not reading proficiently by fourth grade. Almost 70% of Michigan children are not performing well in math by eighth grade. And so these are very troubling troubling statistics on their face. We think it's important, in addition to that early childhood investment, to invest in the parents as well, recognizing that children do better when their families are doing well. So helping families connect the jobs that enable them to support their families and to figure out a life-work balance that make them available to take care of their kids.
There's been a greater concern and talk about sharing in the prosperity of the state and making sure that low-income workers or those out of work can get the kind of training they want. I assume that those kinds of efforts can't just be done at the state level. They have to be done in the private sector as well to make sure the workers are well-trained and able to take care of their families. Do you think that we have to go beyond the mentality of government can't do it all? We really have to get the private sector involved in making sure that families are strong.
This is absolutely the case. In fact, what we've seen is that too often, if government is left to its own devices, there may be training that is provided, but it isn't necessarily training for the skills that the private sector is hiring for. So there's got to be a much closer partnership between employers and the public workforce development systems so that sector by sector, the skills that are being trained for actually fit with what employers say that they need. And that's going to take a whole different kind of partnership between employers and government, recognizing that it's good for employers and it's good for the public generally when families are doing well.
Patrick McCarthy is the president and chief executive officer of Kids Count. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks so much.
Still to come, some Democratic lawmakers in the state House are introducing legislation that would amend Michigan's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. We'll have that story in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Recently, scientists issued a statement indicating the world's atmospheric carbon dioxide level had reached 400 parts per million. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the level was about 280 parts per million. For those concerned about climate change, this is an alarming threshold. We don't know yet what it will mean in the coming decades, but the last time the CO2 level was this high in the atmosphere, about 2.5 million years ago, the Earth was a much warmer, much different place. Those who've been concerned about climate change have been talking about this, and some have taken action. One of those people lives here in Michigan. Matthew Grokoff with Greenovation.tv joins me. So, Matthew, since 2008, I was counting up. I've done something like 15 stories about your house or about energy efficiency or water efficiency in homes. You've been working on this 112-year-old house in Ann Arbor, making it energy efficient, finally adding solar panels to make the home the oldest net-zero energy home in North America. So I want to get an update. You've had a couple of years now of solar power. How has solar energy been working out for you?
It's been fantastic. We've achieved net-zero energy, and our next stage is actually net-zero water. We're at the point where we've proven what's possible with retrofitting an old house, and these things it's kind of a no-brainer at this point. We say that net-zero energy is really not a challenge. It's a choice. Net-zero water is a little bit more challenging.
Well, let's talk about the energy portion of that because you've had some experience now with it. Are you actually producing more energy than you use in a year?
So right now we are producing more energy than we consume in a year. Today, as met right at this moment, even though it's a little bit cloudy, there is more energy going back to the grid than the house is using.
Now, people get excited about this idea of producing their own energy. People, you know, wanting to get off the grid or something like that. But you're actually not off the grid. They also want to talk about adding backyard wind turbines or slapping up solar panels on the roof. But one of the things you've stressed again and again is reduce, reduce, and then produce. What do you mean by that?
The greatest power source, the greatest untapped power source we have in the United States is what Amory Lovins refers to as the negawatt, which is basically energy efficiency. It's the fifth fuel. It's not solar panels. Solar panels can produce energy. But if you are not using that optimally, if you're not getting every benefit for every kilowatt hour that you're using, it's really optimizing the energy that's already being provided to us. If we're using light bulbs in a non-occupied room, we get zero benefit. We want to flip that model on its head. We want to say that every single energy unit that is coming into the home is being used in every single building. It's called just-in-time energy delivery. It's not Justin Bieber, not Justin Timberlake. It's just-in-time energy. So it's the same concept as manufacturing, where you want to deliver that product and the parts to it exactly at the moment that you need them and no more and no less. Anything else is simply waste or inefficiency or unoptimized opportunity. And so energy, we can do the same thing.
So we're thinking about, you know, as you mentioned, the light bulb example, you know, strategic lighting, making sure that it's on and off at the proper times. But we're also talking about, you know, those really not very sexy things like insulation. I mean, just insulating a house, and that's probably one of the biggest problems for the housing stock that's over, you know, 10 years old now, is it's poorly insulated, not insulated as well as it can be. But it's hard to get people excited about insulation.
And there's no reason to get excited about insulation, actually, because that's not the reason that we live. The reality is that there's every single building in the U.S., whether it's been a large-scale office building or the 300,000-square-foot Exploratorium Science Museum in San Francisco, every building that has achieved net zero energy has done it without experimental technologies. We've spent a lot of time focusing on what they call the envelope, the insulation and the ceiling and the windows and all these other things. The biggest missed opportunity is really how we're using energy inside of the building, because once we get that heating and air conditioning system very efficient, the remaining load is all that other stuff that we bring into the office and the home, all the Xboxes and the copy machines and everything else that we're plugging into the walls. So now the real challenge is finding a way to use all of the existing technology and integrate that process so that we're getting 100% of the benefit for the energy that's coming into the building.
So solar panels are supposed to be getting cheaper as it becomes more popular. Are they really getting any cheaper, and are they getting any more efficient?
Yes. This is like Moore's Law.
Right.
3 years ago when we put up our solar panels, we paid about $7 an installed watt. Right here in Ann Arbor, I know someone who just installed a system for $3.30, literally half of what we paid. Our panels were 18% efficient. Now there's 20% efficient panels on the market. So you're able to produce more energy in a smaller space for less cost, and it's only getting better every single day.
So how long will it take for somebody who makes savings through solar energy, through more efficiency, to pay off the still pretty steep price of installing solar?
Well, that's actually one of the challenges. It's not even the payback. It's actually financing the upfront cost of these things, because anybody who can do it, it's a no-brainer. Basically, you're pre-purchasing all of your energy for life. If you can optimize the energy inside the building and then produce all the energy that's needed, you're done. You've eliminated your energy cost. And the challenge is for businesses doing that before your competition does. For homeowners, it's figuring out ways that we can optimize that. But the regulatory system is this very top-down monopolistic system does not allow for the democratizing of the grid. If you want to put solar panels on your roof and sell it to your neighbor like they do in Germany, we unfortunately can't do that here. So a lot of these rules need to be changed, and the financing mechanisms need to be changed. If you can imagine going out and buying a car, if it was the same thing. We went in and got a Chevy in a matter of hours. It took us over 6 months of research and working together to try to figure out how we were going to get those solar panels on the roof. So all of these systems need to change and make it easier for the consumer to get those the ability to produce the energy for their own home.
So it's not just a simple matter of slapping up solar energy and taking advantage of that. It's a matter of being able to work on the grid, working with your utility, which in some cases is not an easy thing. You know, when I'm on a co-op and I see these magazine articles written by the president of my co-op who constantly is saying coal is the solution to our problem because coal is so cheap and plentiful and coal is going to be there for the next century.
Yeah.
Just ignoring all the other concerns about fossil fuels.
Yeah. My best guess is that coal is not going to be the energy of the future, and neither is oil. We're actually producing less oil in the United States now than we were before 1950s levels. You're looking at the real issues here are like interconnection, municipal permitting. So interconnecting with the utility company, how do you do that? Most utility companies will not allow you to put up more than you use. So if half of your usage is gas and the remainder is electricity, they're only going to let you put up enough solar panel to replace that amount of electricity, not the gas portion of that, and certainly not sell it to your neighbors. Permitting. Every single municipality has a different set of rules. It's easier for a contractor to go out from one municipality to another to put up a deck than it is solar panels. And again, imagine if this were the case where they said, it's like, oh yeah, I'll build that deck for you. Oh, you live in Albion? I'm not sure what the permitting requirements are for building a deck in Albion. We'd never get decks built. So these things all need to be standardized, and the Clean Energy Coalition is actually working with several municipalities to try to do that that are all nearby each other. But the real solution is to do this statewide. So we have an advantage over other states. So you're bringing in businesses and you're bringing in employees from other states that will live here in Michigan because it's so much easier to levelize their energy costs. And then other states also have things like property tax exemptions, where they're not being assessed for the value, the added value of the solar panels.
So it seems that the only thing to Trump politics is saving money, but people concerned about climate change keep talking about saving the planet. And I wonder if you expect the debate to shift, or should it even shift, away from that saving the planet to saving money idea?
You know, I think we need both, because the financial argument really makes no sense if we don't have a habitable planet in which to have an economy. So we need that sense of urgency. People need to understand how important this is. PricewaterhouseCoopers projected that at current rates, we could be at 1,200 parts per million, up from the 400 parts where we are right now by the year 2050. In order to stay below 450, we're talking about needing 5.2% reduction from where we are now of carbon emissions every single year through 2050. So this is an urgent, urgent thing, but it's also an incredible opportunity. If you look at who's really buying in to net zero energy and renewable energy production, companies like Walmart, Google, and the U.S. Army all have their mission zeros, which by a certain date, they will be powered by 100% renewable energy. Google has gone further and said they will be energy plus and actually be distributing power. These are money-making things. Anybody who can do it before their competition does, levelizing your energy costs or eliminating them, is an extraordinary advantage. And it's something that we can do here in Michigan and create a business advantage for ourselves.
Because of this new method of extracting natural gas called hydraulic fracturing, or actually horizontal hydraulic fracturing, suddenly there's a cheaper supply of natural gas. I'm wondering how that's affecting the arguments for going to renewables.
Well, this is the thing. We really need a broad and diverse portfolio of energy. Whenever we put all of our eggs in one basket, we get hurt. Ohio put a lot of money into coal. They got hurt when those prices changed. They don't have the natural gas infrastructure that, say, Michigan even has right now. So we need to find a broader base of fuels. If you look at the price of coal or natural gas or petroleum, there's not a commodity trader in the world that's going to be able to tell you what the price of that's going to be at the end of the trading day today. But we know what the price of renewables like wind and solar are going to be 10,000 years from now. So we need to be adding that into the mix. And one of the most extraordinary things, if you look at the projections for where the energy productions across the country could be by the year 2050, the Great Lakes states, which is not known for our fuels, we don't have the natural resources like Pennsylvania and West Virginia or Wyoming. And yet, we're projected to be one of the biggest, I believe, after the South Central U.S., which includes Texas. So after that, we would be the biggest producers of energy in the country. So the Great Lakes region could be producing more energy than the North Atlantic and Mid-Atlantic states, which is extraordinary considering the fuel that we'd be harvesting is mostly from the wind and from the sun.
Yeah, there's not an ounce of coal in this state. It's all imported. And yes, we have natural gas, but that's a limited supply as well. Matthew Grukoff and his wife, Kelly, own the oldest net zero energy home in North America in Ann Arbor. You can find more information about how they did it and a lot more energy efficiency for the home on greenovation.tv. And you've got a new project you've just started.
Yeah, we've launched the Thrive Net Zero Energy Consulting Collaborative, which basically brings together some of the best minds in the state of Michigan and in the region to work on projects like commercial buildings, even some large-scale homes and schools to optimize their energy and get them to net zero energy. We're working on a project with Habitat for Humanity in Traverse City, a community of 10 homes that is targeting all-electric net zero energy powered completely by the sun.
We'll be looking to hear more about that in the future. Thanks very much, Matt, for coming in.
Hey, Lester, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. It's been written, you will know them by their fruits. And what some congregations of faith are harvesting these days is energy, saving energy, producing energy from the sun, from the wind. Joining me right now is Julie Lyon Brickers. She's the Executive Director of Michigan Interfaith Power and Light. So I've heard that some Christians and other faiths have been looking at this as stewardship of the earth. How did Michigan Interfaith Power and Light get started?
Well, it was founded by Reverend Charles Morris, a Catholic priest out of Wyandotte, Michigan at the time in 2002. And he recognized that there was a disconnect between some of his clergy teachings and a lack of interest and recognition of how we are treating the earth in terms of energy efficiency and renewable technologies and clean energy and social justice. So in 2002, Michigan IPL was born, and it was the third state in the country to take an IPL. Now there are 40 states who participate in this national movement of combining faith and environmental stewardship.
I want to get into the philosophy behind this, but first, what actually do you do?
We help with energy efficiency in houses of worship, so the actual technical upgrades and so forth. We also do energy education for congregations to help congregants understand energy efficiency and sustainability so that they can implement those in their house of worship, but also take it home and implement those ideas in their own residence.
I can imagine with some of these, you know, cavernous buildings, that might be a real cost savings for them on their electric bill and their gas bill.
It certainly is, and that is one of our main goals, to help the congregations tighten up their actual facility building so that the money that they save can be used for more important things, you know, support of community activities that they do and their mission statements and so forth.
Now, among some conservative Christian congregations, denying climate change is kind of standard. And sometimes see environmentalists as tree huggers who worship nature more than God. There is this divide among Christians. How do you deal with that when you're going to them and greening the church?
Well, the way that we approach our work is that it's energy efficiency. And really, energy efficiency spans all denominations. The ability to not be wasteful, you know, has nothing to do with one side or the other, left or right. And so we often approach, you know, the entrance into different denominations and houses of worship when they become our congregation members, just with the idea that we can help them save money, and in turn, that helps them become better stewards. And so often we don't even get into a whole lot of debate about climate change and who's doing what.
I was reading in The Observer where one pastor was commenting that their wind turbine is like their steeple. Apparently, some congregations are really embracing this.
That's correct. Different denominations are moving forward in such a way that the stewardship aspect overrides the energy efficiency and money savings. So, you know, we see both sides of the coin there. But really, we haven't had a whole lot of trouble helping many denominations, conservative and liberal, embrace the idea of moving forward with energy efficiency or renewable technologies.
How many different congregations have you been able to help so far?
Since our beginning, we have probably helped more than 350 move forward with free energy assessments and energy education. Currently, we have about 195 congregational members across the state of all types of denominations. So we're thrilled.
And with thousands of houses of worship of one sort or another, I imagine you still have plenty to do.
Oh, we sure do. We're looking forward to exponential growth. And in Michigan, there are about 11,000 facilities who call themselves houses of worship in the IRS tax-exempt status. So we do have a ways to go. But we think that this grassroots movement can really move forward once we get a hold here.
So you're making a special effort in Detroit. Tell me about that.
Okay, we're just finishing up an energy efficiency pilot program in Detroit with 48 houses of worship. It was a partnership with DTE, and the numbers coming out are saving about 14% on their energy bills project-wide.
All right. You've been listening to Julie Lyon Brickers. She's the Executive Director of Michigan Interfaith Power and Light. Good luck with your work.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, there's lots of talk by people in the Snyder administration that it's their policies that have been helping to boost, albeit slowly, Michigan's economy. Coming up in 10 minutes, we'll talk with an economist and a reporter on the economy about whether the governor's claims are true. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. This morning, some Michigan House Democrats gathered on the front lawn of the Capitol to explain some new bills that would allow marriage for people who are gay or lesbian. Polls of Michigan citizens indicate a growing number of people say it's time for marriage equality for LGBT folks. About 57% approve. And that's quite a turnaround. Just 9 years ago, the people of Michigan approved a state constitutional amendment specifically banning gay marriage. It passed by nearly 59%. So in the midst of this, we're waiting for decisions on two gay rights issues from the U.S. Supreme Court. To help wade through all of this and what it means is Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio Network. So, Rick, you were at this morning's news conference. Who's backing these bills and what would they do?
Well, it is the State House Democrats, and there's also similar legislation in the State Senate, also proposed by Democrats. And I think we can safely say that in this environment, since it's Republicans in charge in the House and the Senate, that this legislation is really more about making a point than making a policy. Nevertheless, it's being rolled out as we're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on same-sex marriage. The wide expectation is that the court will rule narrowly and instead of creating an essential right to marriage, basically leave it to states to do what they will with the question. If that happens, and it is still an if, then that's when all of this would come into play. What Democrats want is for the legislature to basically put gay marriage back on the ballot with a new amendment that would not only reverse the ban on same-sex marriage, recognition of civil unions, denying people a lot of the rights that go along with government recognition of marriage, and also create a specific right to same-sex marriage in the Michigan Constitution. The Speaker of the House has already said that this is a non-starter for him. He says that if this is going to happen, it really ought to be through a citizen-initiated petition drive and not come from the legislature putting it on the ballot, which we should point out that there are plans to launch a petition drive aimed not at next year's election, but at the 2016 ballot when it'll be a presidential year and we would expect higher voter turnout.
Right. And so it's unlikely that these decisions, either by the Supreme Court or that these bills introduced by the House Democrats are going to really tackle some of the larger issues that are not addressed by these, and that things like employment discrimination or housing discrimination. So is this really just the first salvo by the Democrats on this issue, just basically staking out their territory?
Well, yeah, it's like I said, this is about making a point rather than a policy, that we are actually seeing some activity surrounding amending Michigan's civil rights law, which you know, the legislature can do without going to the ballot to include LGBT protections, but that's still some time away. And then the other thing is, even though the Supreme Court will do what the Supreme Court will do, there is still a case in the U.S. District Court in Detroit that deals with Michigan's gay marriage ban. That's in front of Judge Bernard Friedman. And he invited the litigants to do an argument, basically an equal protection argument on Michigan's gay marriage ban. It started out as a case that dealt basically with adoption rights for same-sex couples.
Right, a lesbian couple that wanted to have what they call second parent adoption. That federal judge said he was going to wait for the U.S. Supreme Court.
He said that once the U.S. Supreme Court rules, he will issue a ruling, no more hearings, no more arguments, and do something that comports with whatever the Supreme Court outlines. And it could deal strictly with adoption rights. Judge Friedman could decide to cast a wider net.
I want to ask you about one more thing. One of the Democrats this morning, Representative Sam Singh, was quoted as saying, "This is an opportunity to right a wrong," talking about this package of bills. The Speaker of the House, Republican Jace Bulger, has said he's willing to talk about adding protections for LGBT people under the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, but would have to balance these concerns with people's religious liberties. And the governor says, "This is not on my agenda." What are we supposed to make from all these comments from Lansing?
Well, you know, when we don't say that the phrase "not on my agenda" is not used by the governor anymore, not since the right to work. But I mean, what it says is a few things. One of them is that Republicans are treading very lightly on the question of gay rights, that they recognize that public opinion has shifted on that. Yet at the same time, that people who have a serious moral objection to same-sex marriage and same-sex relationships are still a crucial part of the Republican coalition, and they don't want to offend that part of their base. And so what it says is that Republicans and the conservative movement are trying to figure out how they're going to manage this issue going forward.
All right. That's Rick Pluta. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks very much, Rick.
Oh, my pleasure, Lester.
This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. The Snyder administration has maintained its relentless positive action to reinvent Michigan, restructured taxes to give businesses a better than $1 billion tax break to encourage job growth in Michigan. He approved the right to work law, which proponents insist will bring jobs to Michigan. And there has been some growth in jobs, but it's been kind of anemic. Joining us is Charles Ballard. He's a professor of economics at Michigan State University, and Rick Haglund, who is a freelance writer for Bridge Magazine, MLive, a blogger at MichEconomy.com. I'm not sure who else you write for, Rick, but I couldn't keep up with your pace. Let's talk about the economy a little bit and start with unemployment. In April, the Michigan unemployment rate was 8.4%. That was the 42nd worst rate in the nation and nearly a percentage higher than the national average of 7.5%. So, Professor Ballard, let's start with you. What's that tell you?
Well, we're 42nd best or ninth worst. But remember, not long ago, we were 50th best. We had the highest unemployment rate in the nation. So Michigan, we're different now from what we were 30 years ago, but we're similar in that we are still much more heavily dependent on durable goods manufacturing and autos in particular than any other state in the country. And what that means, since that's a cyclical industry, that means that when the nation as a whole has a bad spot, it's really bad for Michigan.
The old adage,
yeah. The United States gets a cold, we get pneumonia.
Right.
That is still true, perhaps less than it was 30 years ago, but still true. And so the worst recession of our lifetime for the United States, which took the U.S. unemployment rate up to 10%, it's no surprise that it took the Michigan unemployment rate up to 14%. And then we've had a recovery, and we've recovered somewhat better than the national average. But so much of this is due to a national and really global business cycle. I'm not saying that Governor Snyder's policies have hurt, but I really think that if you look at Engler, Granholm, Snyder, we give governors way too much credit when things go well. And we give them way too much blame when things go badly, when so much of what goes on is really way beyond the control of our local government. We love to be the masters of our own fate. But let's face it, we are 3% of the U.S. economy, and we have completely open borders with the rest of the country and really the rest of the world. For better or worse, things that happen beyond our borders have a profound effect.
Rick Haglund, you've written about anemic job numbers. What's your take?
Well, the employment figures seem to be slowing down in the past 12 months or so. I was just looking at some of the numbers this morning, and, you know, 67% of the new payroll jobs that Michigan has added over the past 12 months are in manufacturing, which kind of supports what Charlie had just mentioned about how we're so dependent on the auto industry in this state. There were some state GDP numbers that came out, and it shows that Michigan's GDP grew 2.2% in 2012. That was down from 3.5% in 2011 and 4.9% in 2010. And we're growing a little bit slower than the national economy. The U.S. GDP for last year was 2.5%. So we've grown. You know, we're much better than we were 2 or 3 years ago, but the growth has been somewhat anemic, and it appears to be slowing down as the expansion gets a little bit older.
I was reading this morning there's been a small year-over-year increase in the seasonally adjusted payroll jobs in Michigan. Last April, there were about 4,025,000. This April, about 4,057,000. That's 32,000 jobs, but if Rick is right, that means the bulk of them are auto jobs. So I'm wondering if these improvements in the economy we have seen, can the governor claim credit for it, or is it purely the auto industry?
Well, the governor can claim credit for it, and he certainly will. I mean, if I were in his shoes, I would claim credit for it. But I think, honestly, that so much of this has to do with, as I said, things happening really in the global markets and especially in the global auto market. And remember that we hit bottom at the end of 2009, and then a very large portion of this recovery happened in the last year of Jennifer Granholm's administration. And then 2011 was perhaps the best year of the recovery. That was Snyder's first year, but his policies didn't have any time to take effect until the following year. And so that's not saying that Snyder's policies – I actually think that they're sort of a mixed bag with some good policies and some not so good. But they can't be credited for much of this recovery. And honestly, you look at Engler, many strong years in the 90s, and then our economy really fell apart in the last 2.5 years of John Engler's administration. He didn't change policies. The national economy slipped into a recession.
I wanted to bring up an article I was reading in The Atlantic by Jordan Weisman of the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis found that Americans have recovered 62% of the wealth that disappeared during the Great Recession. But he noted much of this rebound in national net worth has been a result of increasing stock prices, which mostly benefit the wealthiest families. So he concludes that this recovery is led by the rich, mostly for the rich. And I was wondering, do you think that's the case in Michigan, or is it somehow different here?
It's not a whole lot different here. Michigan is like many states. We have seen really over the last 40 years, not just over the last couple of years, this widening gap between the top and the middle. The middle has not pulled away from the bottom. It's that the top has pulled away from the middle, and that's true in Michigan and elsewhere.
Rick, I was in January at the state capitol at the beginning of the year. George Fulton, an economist at the University of Michigan, made a presentation to a legislative committee. Among the things I noticed was a projected slowdown in disposable income or purchasing power of Michigan residents. It's not keeping pace with the rest of the nation because of new taxes on retirees' pensions, a smaller tax credit for working poor, elimination of special tax exemptions for seniors and children, and homestead property tax credit. So I'm wondering, we've got all this going on while we've got this rosier picture for business. Do you think the average, given what we talked about in that article in The Atlantic, given what George Fulton was projecting, do you think the average Michigan resident is feeling any better now while Wall Street is, above 15,000 on the Dow?
I think it's kind of a mixed bag. I hear a lot of discontent from people in terms about their pay and their employment prospects. George Fulton and Don Grimes did a thing in their latest state economic forecast that showed that the average wage in Michigan is about $5,000 less than in the rest of the country. We have an older population, so the pension tax hit certain number of people, and they're unhappy about it. But on the other hand, I mean, you see some good things going on. Car sales are up both nationally and in Michigan as well. And I look around southeast Michigan, I see a lot of new home construction. So I think there's some confidence out there, and the rebound has benefited some people. One of the things that some of the economists, Charlie probably among them, had talked about, that some of the tax cuts that Snyder and the legislature enacted actually really had the effect of a tax shift, where taxes were cut for businesses, particularly small businesses. They were the personal income tax rate went up and a bit, and it was applied to people with pensions. So in essence, you've had somewhat of a shift. And I think if you look at the state budget, that has not really gone down in the past few years.
I have one last question for both of you. We're less than a year and a half away from elections, and we already know that there is a Democrat who's likely to become the nominee, Mark Schauer, who will be challenging Rick Snyder. I'm predicting a little bit there, but I think it's a safe assumption. And given that Governor Snyder's popularity is not great among voters, do you think he can see enough of an improvement in the economy to claim credit for it and recover from where his numbers are right now? Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, you know, I track this with the State of the State survey, which is a quarterly public opinion poll that we have at Michigan State. Governor Snyder's numbers have never been particularly strong. And even in his first time in office back a couple of years ago, we found 44%, 44.5% either excellent or good. Those are not horrible numbers, but they're not great. And then he slipped into the 30s. I think it's fair to say that it will not be an easy election, an easy re-election for Governor Snyder. He had really an easy time in 2010. 2010 was a watershed year for Republicans nationally, a lot of discontent with Democrats. It's going to be tougher for him to achieve re-election. Not to say that he won't, but I think we're going to have a real contest on our hands.
Do you have any idea if the economy is going to improve enough to benefit his argument that he's changed the state?
Well, the fact that it's likely to continue to recover some. But again, as you've emphasized, that recovery is spread very unevenly. Some folks have done really well, but there are the average citizen in Michigan, as in much of the rest of the country, has had a pretty so-so few years here. And so I think it's going to be very mixed.
Rick Hagelin, what's your thoughts?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, a lot can happen between now and 2014. I was struck by a recent poll that came out that showed Mark Schauer actually beating Snyder in a head-to-head matchup for governor. To me, that seemed kind of unusual in the fact that I suspect Mark Schauer does not have a lot of name recognition throughout the state. So I don't know if it's so much people saying they're in favor of him or if they're against Rick Snyder. I think one of the factors that he's going to have that may be telling is where the economy does go over the next year. I mean, if it just continues to sort of bounce along at sort of uninspired rates, I think it could be trouble for him. Or if it gets worse, obviously, if for some reason it really takes off early in 2014 or the mid of 2014, that puts him in a better position. But I would agree with Charlie. I think it's going to be quite a race.
Rick Hagelin writes for a variety of magazines and online sites, and gosh knows how many there are, as well as MishEconomy.com on the economy. Thanks very much, Rick. And Charles Ballard, he's a professor of economics at Michigan State University. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stateside executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Thury, April Van Buren. The program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Let's talk again tomorrow.